This is WJBC This Week.
We need to embrace this decision by Mitsubishi as a new opportunity for our community.
We've gotten through tough times in the past. We'll get through this as well.
In the probable cause statement, we included some GSR, gunshot residue evidence, which we think is an indication of who we think did the offense.
My obligation was to spend $1 million of my own money for the equipment in the building. So I have skin in the game.
My husband's a patriotic person. He believes in the promise of our country and a promise of our legal system and our justice system. And he believes that at some point it's got to be made right.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, Bloomington Normal prepares to lose one of its largest employers and looks for ways to save the Mitsubishi plant that will stop production later this year. Governor Rauner addresses the budget stalemate between he and the Democratic-led legislature. Illinois State University President Larry Dietz discusses the impact the state budget uncertainty is having on the Normal campus. A Bloomington man chronicles the U.S. space program through pictures. Plus, we'll take you back to our Throwback Thursday interview with Maria Henneberry. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It was nearly three decades ago that Diamond Star Motors, a combination of Chrysler and Mitsubishi, built a plant in Normal, a plant that at its peak was producing 220,000 cars in a year. But it has been a shell of its former self in the last decade. Financial difficulties led to mass layoffs. And then this week, the company's remaining 1,300 workers were told the company plans to cease production at its only North American plant by the end of November and hopes to find a buyer for the property and jobs for the soon-to-be-displaced workers. Former Bloomington Mayor Jesse Smart was one of the local leaders instrumental in the plant's arrival in Bloomington. He talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Who was Normal up against?
Well, it wasn't Normal. It was the community. And at that time, there was a place in Michigan, a place near Lafayette, Indiana, and I don't remember the others, but I know it got down to the three of us. And we put together a package which really represented the community. And we had all of our people, the Illinois Power Rep, Corn Belt, you name it, if they did business in this community, you know, of that nature, they were invited. And that was really a successful venture on our part, because they got to know a lot of people in the community, and they felt comfortable here. And when it was all said and done, people had been in the negotiations. They told us this afterwards, voted, where would you rather live? And they all said here.
That must have been an incredible boost of confidence for Bloomington Normal.
Yeah. And we have to say a lot for Governor Jim Thompson. He worked feverishly on this.
The departure has been rumored for a while, and of course we now know it is confirmed. What did the plant mean to the community over the 30 years it was here, especially in the beginning?
We were very, very short of blue-collar, you know, with this terminology of describing it, jobs. And one of the reasons we were working so hard to try to get them here was to help the blue-collar job situation. You know, we have State Farm that provides a lot of white-collar jobs, and the two universities and what have you. So we really were in dire straits to balance of employment in this community, and they did it.
Jesse, do you remember 1988 opening day?
Yes, I do very well.
Tell me about that day.
Well, first I'll talk about the groundbreaking day.
Yeah.
That was exciting because that meant that everything was official. And I remember in my little talk out there on the ground, you said, welcome and what have you in Japanese. But anyway, the day they started the plant was really exciting because it had come, they had hired all the people, and as I recall, there were, what, close to 3,000 at the beginning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was really, really one of the big days for the community.
In 1988, they produced 2,200 cars. Then in 1989, it jumped to 90,000. Got to a high of, I believe, somewhere around 250,000 vehicles they were producing per year. And what was...
They introduced a term to us that nobody knew about, as far as I know, until they came, and that was the slow launch.
The slow launch. What does that mean exactly?
That means you start out slow enough that you can correct all mistakes and train people as you go along. And it really pays off in the long run because everybody's well-trained. They're not rushing things through without doing it right. And I'd never heard that term before, you know, being a farm boy like I was. But since then, I did it in my own business when I started it. I made no bones. I was going to follow the Mitsubishi emblem and do a slow launch.
Jesse, the first thing people see when they drive on 74 is that sign for the Mitsubishi motorway exit.
Yeah.
Tell me about the naming of that.
Well, it sort of was, was identified the area definitely as to what it was, but it also was an honor to the plant to have their name on their own street.
Yeah, and that's exactly what's right off that exit. That was an exit directly to the plant is today.
Right.
Did an exit exist there before?
Excuse me?
Did the exit exist there before?
Yeah, but I don't know what it was called then. It's been too long. But, you know, the thing that we don't want to forget is the number of supplier jobs there are here.
Yeah.
That's more than people would realize. And those are the people that are also going to be adversely affected. And when we think about the 900 or whatever they employ out there, that's only a beginning.
When
all those suppliers and other people whose jobs depend on that plant being there.
When I tell people about where I live, I brag that we make the number one selling Mitsubishi vehicle in the U.S. here. It's mm-hmm. something to brag about. Go through the last 24 hours with me and when you first heard about the closing.
When I first heard about it on the news last night, first I thought, well, we've had these rumors before, and this is probably just another one of those. And, and then number two, I thought maybe this is an effort to get the union's attention for negotiations. You know, these are all just hopeful thoughts, that's what there is to it. But then today when we find out it is actually official, my next question is, what do we do to turn it around? And I just hope that the current governor will work as hard to keep it here as Governor Thompson worked to get it here.
That was former Bloomington Mayor Jesse Smart with Terry James. And to the question of what can be done to save the plant and its nearly 1,300 workers, that was posed before a panel of local and state officials at a news conference in Uptown Normal on Friday, starting with the Normal mayor, Chris Coos.
Given the very modern and well-maintained production facility, the outstanding transportation infrastructure to serve the facility, and the availability of a highly trained and ready labor force, we are confident that we will be able to attract a replacement company in relatively short order. We have already reached out to Governor Bruce Rauner, DCEO Chairman Director Jim Schultz, U.S. Senators Dick Durbin and Mark Kirk, along with the remaining members of our state and federal legislative delegation. All have pledged their full support in our efforts to find a new company to occupy the Mitsubishi production facility once it closes later this year. And at this point, we'll open for questions for any person at the podium here today.
Mr. Mayor, had Mitsubishi given you any indication prior to today? We've heard the rumors for weeks, and going back as recent as 2011, there was an effort to, quote-unquote, save the plant. Were you expecting this in any way, shape, or form?
No, not at all. We had no prior notice of this, and frankly, you know, I think it came pretty quickly for the local people as well.
Did they give you an indication why?
Yes, they did. It had to do with production numbers, and what affected Mitsubishi here locally was sales of the Outlander Sport, and they had very aggressive sales in Russia, and when the Russian economy kind of faltered, those sales quit. And Mitsubishi, I think, is looking at this as the Outlander Sport as a product that they can take into Asia in their current facilities for production. They have capacity to handle that car, so I think that's what drove the decision.
Do you, at this point, are you looking at a few weeks still of production in there, or is it pretty much stop immediately, or what's the timeline?
The timeline is the end of the year is what Mitsubishi has told us. They will continue production through the end of the year.
What do you tell the people who work there? Of course, there's a possibility their jobs could be retained, but they may start to think we should consider moving away. What do you tell them to reassure them that even if this doesn't pan out, that this is their best place to remain?
Well, I think, you know, we've said that before. You've seen the outpouring of support and help from everybody standing here at the podium today. Obviously, they have to look out for their own best interests, but we're here to stand with them and help them in any way we possibly can to keep them in McLean County and the region.
If I could just add to that, this is a severe challenge, and our committee has faced other challenges in the past, and I know that our state officials and our other local officials, we're all committed to making sure that we make progress in our community. So we've gotten through tough times in the past. We'll get through this as well.
Is it possible to get a replacement that's comparable at all to Mitsubishi in terms of the size of the company that would come in? Or?
Yes, I believe it is. It's speaking what we're talking about. From the state perspective and the DCEO and the governor's office, I've been in contact with this morning, as well as I'm sure Senator Brady has and others. And there are ongoing discussions. There are ongoing things that I think could be beneficial down the road. I'm not at liberty to disclose those right at this moment, but we're going to be working as aggressively as we can. The governor has put members of the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity here locally, and we're working with Kyle Hamm. The wheels are in motion in that respect, but it's going to be difficult. We're not going to kid anybody, and the union representatives that are here today, we thank them for what they're trying to do. Their officials are in Detroit right now trying to make discussions and make something come out of this, and so together we're going to do that. I think there's roughly 918 union members that are represented by the UAW there. There's roughly 1,200 workers within the plant, and we're going to do everything we can from the state perspective to help. And we need to pursue and aggressively pursue a buyer.
That was State Representative Dan Brady from Friday's news conference, along with the Normal Mayor Chris Kuss and Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. And Governor Rauner has some other pressing issues to tend to as we approach 1 month since Illinois began a new budget year without a spending plan. And Rauner and the legislative leaders on the other side of the aisle don't appear to be any closer to a deal. The governor talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
You sound worn out.
No risk of that. You know what? It's a battle to turn our state around, and we will never flinch. We'll never give in. It's just a long slog.
But, you know, I'm even hearing from Republicans downstate, you know, you say you're not going to flinch, and people are looking for compromise because right now some good people are going to suffer if something doesn't get done.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's why we've been willing to compromise on many things. You know, to turn Illinois around, we need a lot of things to change. But we've taken many of those off the table, dozens of them off the table.
Can you give me some examples of what you've done on your side to compromise, what you call compromise?
Yeah, so we want a long-term property tax freeze, and taxes, so property taxes can only go up if voters say they can go up. We've taken that off the table. We've taken it down just to two-year freeze, only a two-year freeze, not longer. And many of the things to control local property taxes around collective bargaining and prevailing wage. We've said, let's take those off the table. Let's keep a prevailing wage statewide. Let's do a number of the things that the Madigan's pushed back on. We've compromised and taken off the table. He's had no compromise. All he's done, passed an unbalanced, unconstitutional budget to the tune of $4 billion hole, and then he said, and Governor, you raise taxes to fix it. And you know what? That's baloney. That's not the way to run a state government.
There was a tweet from an Illinois lawmaker, I think yesterday, that said, we're back to square zero. We're back to square negative two. So where does that leave things?
Well, you know what? We've made good progress with many members of the General Assembly. And I've had good negotiations with President Cullerton in the Senate. He's come up with some good ideas. He's shown willingness to compromise, and we've integrated a number of his ideas into our proposal. Also, Mayor Emanuel, who's got a lot of influence with legislators down in Springfield. Chicago has deep financial trouble, and he's offered to help and propose compromise and ideas that'll work that we're trying to integrate. So we're making progress, but the one holdup, the one person, and he's got the power over a lot of the legislators, is Speaker Madigan. You know, he's been in power for over 30 years, the most powerful politician in the state. He is all about protecting his power and protecting the political class in Illinois. That's why he's fighting us on term limits. He's fighting us on redistricting reform. He's fighting us on workers' comp and tort reform that can grow our economy and get more employers here hiring people. He doesn't want to do that because the tort lawyers, the trial lawyers who fund him millions of dollars, make so much money off our broken lawsuit system. So he's protecting the political class against the middle class and protecting his power, and that's what's got to change.
So worst case scenario, where do you see this thing going? He's not going to back down. You compromised. You say you've taken some things off the table. He's not backing down. Where do you see this going?
Well, you know what? We'll just continue to negotiate in good faith. When Governor Jim Edgar first got into office, he and Madigan got into a stalemate. It was towards the end of July before they got a budget. And Illinois did not have anywhere near the financial disaster that we have now back then. So this is going to take a little while. The one thing that Speaker Madigan's got and the politicians he controls in the General Assembly have got to understand, these sham budgets, these unconstitutional budgets don't work, and these one-month budgets that they try to pass, all that does is put us in a $4 billion hole 1 month at a time. And the social agencies who've come to me and said, please, let's not have cuts. I say, I don't want to have cuts. Speaker Madigan, if he really had integrity in this process, he could pass a tax hike. He's got a supermajority. He doesn't need me to do a tax hike. He knows, his members know that reforms are needed. They are unwilling to raise taxes unless I do it, and that's wrong. I want reforms before I'll talk about revenue. And you know what? In the end, what the social service agencies have said to me is, Bruce, we know we need reforms, and please tell the Speaker that these one-month budgets don't help social service agencies. We can't run month-to-month. We need long-term contracts. And I said, I know that. That's exactly why I'm against these one-month budgets. So please, let's all call Speaker Madigan. Let him know that these sham votes and unbalanced budgets don't work. Let's get reform so we can properly fund our service.
Do you think that a call to a downstate phone call to Mike Madigan is going to do any good?
You know what? He pays attention to what his members say. Now, he's got a lot of control over him. He controls the spigot of campaign cash to the members. That's the reason they live in fear of him, and he controls them. But you know what? If people around the state, the people of Illinois, call their state representative, call the members of the General Assembly and say, look, we don't like taxes, but Rauner's willing to compromise. We don't want an unbalanced budget, and we do need reforms. Term limits, redistricting reform, property tax controls, and pro-growth job creation reforms. We need those. Please tell the Speaker to support it. They'll do it. They'll go to the Speaker and do it. I've already heard that some are starting to do it, and more of your listeners need to call in.
Do you have his phone number?
Come on the website. You can look it up. And look up who your state rep is. Know who your state rep is and know who your state senator is. Call them and say, please vote for some reforms so we can get a truly balanced budget, we can properly fund our social services, and stop protecting Mike Madigan, his Chicago political machine, and the political class in Illinois.
That was Governor Bruce Rauner with Scott and Colleen. The state budget uncertainty makes for tenuous times for educators, including those at Illinois State University, who are unsure of the constraints they might be forced to operate under in the new year. ISU President Larry Dietz talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
First of all, have you heard anything when it comes to funding higher education? We know when the governor released his list of priorities, funding higher education definitely was not at the top of the list.
Well, we haven't heard any new news out of that. We have people who are in Springfield every day, and we're in constant communication back and forth. I regularly talk with legislators from our area here. So the communication is very strong, but there hasn't I'm sure there's a lot of discussion going on, but in terms of actual progress toward this, it's hard to gauge that. The bottom line is that the state right now this last year has given us money that represents 18% of the budget here. So we have been using complementary revenue sources for many, many years. It's also not unusual for the state not to come up with money at the beginning of the fiscal year. So this is not a new dilemma. It's always frustrating when that doesn't happen, because people are uncertain. But at the same token, our folks are being paid, and they're being paid out of these other revenue sources that we have, and we plan to continue to do that until the state decides what is the right amount for us to get, and whatever that amount is, we'll be happy to receive that. Our planning processes are in good shape, and we'll soldier on down the road on the thing. So we're very positive about the future, and we have plans in place to accommodate whatever is decided at the state level.
And again, we're talking with President Larry Dietz with the Illinois State University. Can you expound on those plans at all? Because the Board of Trustees met in a special meeting a little while back, and they just did a very slight tuition increase. However, if the cuts come through, as has been talked about from the governor's office, the university really might have to make some deeper either revenue increases or spending cuts.
Well, right now we would probably be doing the spending cuts, and the first thing that we would look at within any of those cuts would be the non-people part of that. Basically, we would continue to defer some of our maintenance programs and plans that we have, as a part of a normal course of the year. We'd probably further delay some of those construction projects and renovation projects and deferred maintenance projects. Then beyond that, you quickly get into things that are people related, but it doesn't do a lot of good to speculate on that. We've got plans in place that we were asked to submit. If the 31.5% cut that the governor had proposed, if that's in place, we have plans for 10%, 20%. But we could spend every waking hour providing those different scenarios, and it really doesn't do much good until the final one comes down. So depending upon the percentage of the and of the cut, we'll implement various plans that but our most important resource are our people here, the faculty and the staff that teach and serve the students. And so we want to preserve that. That's our highest priority.
That was ISU President Larry Dietz with Terry James. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. As we mark the 46th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing this week, a Bloomington man, J.L. Pickering, has collaborated with John Bisney on two books which provide a photographic history of the U.S. space program with many never-before-seen pictures. Pickering and Bisney talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
What was the impetus to put together a book of what is books, a series of books that are going to contain some absolutely fantastic visuals for people to look at?
Well, really what it was is J.L. and I are both baby boomers who are space enthusiasts. So whenever we go to the library or a bookstore, we look to see what space books there are. And if you thumb through them, we realized you're looking at the same 50 to 60 pictures over and over and over again. And it's understandable because they're good images. They're great images. I mean, they're the most famous images of the space program. But authors just don't go beyond what we call the greatest hits. And thanks to JL's amazing personal collection, there are tens of thousands of photos that were taken of the space program that have just never been published. So we said, let's take advantage of what JL has pulled together over a lifetime and put together a book of images that you haven't seen from the space program.
And those are just fascinating. The quality of pictures and visuals that came out of all those areas is spectacular. I mean, they didn't take these on Kodak cameras or Polaroids. These are top shelf pieces of visuals to look
at. That's right.
The JL, I hear that you had a huge collection of this. I had a collection at one time. I'm about the same age, I'm presuming. I'm a baby boomer. And in the 60s, we had two rock stars that we looked at. One was, of course, played guitar, and the other one flew in spaceships. It was just, right. It was a remarkable time to be a youngster growing up with NASA and things like that.
Yeah, those were real heroes back then.
They were. And I actually got on a mailing list. I kept writing letters to NASA. And every couple of weeks or so, I would get a packet of pictures.
Oh, boy.
Sometimes I got space
tank. You could have been one of us, Ian.
I could have. And when I saw this and I started looking at this, I said, I think I had that picture. And so I get it. And the books started out, I'm guessing, as a labor of love, and now they've just grown into something even bigger than that. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, it's getting that way, sure. We've got the Apollo 1 coming out in the fall, and we're certainly kicking around a shuttle version as well. We've been asked about it regularly wherever we go, so I think we're going to have to dive into that a little bit.
Absolutely.
That's a whole different program. There's a ton of missions there, but I think we're at least going to tackle the early 25 or 6 flights.
Yeah, now your books have chapters that are designated for each particular space flight, which really helps people get an idea of what that program or those programs, the Mercury,
right,
the Gemini, what they had to go through.
An amazing stuff, and we think we're the only time, this is the only time anybody's put a book together with individual chapters on each one of those missions as well. Usually they take a program and they group, we'll take the Gemini program, put it all together in 4 or 5 pages. And we've got 10, 12 pages for each mission. But I know what you're seeing as far as the photos go. We've tried to really detail what took place to get one of those flights ready to go, all the way from the training aspects all the way through the recovery.
And what I hope it does for readers, Dan, is it shows you very well how NASA took a very careful step-by-step approach to get to the moon. It was a series of small, careful steps, each one building on the next one. And I think a lot of this book demonstrates how each mission, as I say, built on the last one and moved the program forward.
These pictures came from where? I mean, you said you had a huge collection, but where did you collect them from?
Well, it started with a lot of letter writing back when I was 12, 13, 14 years old. It eventually grows to making phone calls to people. And then you eventually, as soon as you're old enough to drive, then you go visit people. You visit retirees, you visit with press people. Amazing stuff that these guys would bring home from work. So once they retire, then you go ask them what they've got tucked away in their attics. And they say, well, no, nobody's ever asked me about this stuff. Let me see what I got. And pretty soon you're adding bits and pieces. I'd go to Florida and come back with, 200-300 prints and scan away. Then eBay came along. Then big-time auctions come along. And you're always looking for things you haven't seen before. And I've been doing this long enough, I can pick out images right away and know whether or not I have that in my archives or if it's something I need to pursue. So it's a strange talent. But
I'm not sure, John, but I think he's just bragging now, don't you?
I'll brag a little bit. It is sort of amazing because he has this, excuse the expression, a photographic memory. And what's astonishing to me is, you can have a book of 20 different launches of a Saturn V, and they all look the same to me.
But JL can sit there and say, oh, that's Apollo 6, that's Apollo 9, that's Apollo 12. So he's really something.
Okay, I thought I was into it. I have now been put back into my place in the world.
Well, it's like even the other night we went to dinner with a gentleman who worked at one of the Florida newspapers for years down here. And he brings a package of 200 or so photos with him that I left with. So, I mean, it used to be I used to have to seek this stuff out all the time.
Yeah.
And now it's coming to me on a pretty regular basis, which is great.
That was J.L. Pickering and John Bisney with our Dan Swaney. Maria Henneberry started her broadcasting career at WJVC in the mid-1990s, before later going into television, lecturing, and leadership. She talked with Dan Swaney and Colleen Reynolds this week in our Throwback Thursday interview.
What were some of your big stories that you covered personally when you were here?
Oh, that's a great question. You know what? I did a lot of beat stuff. I had the Bloomington police beat. I did a lot of that kind of thing. So I got to know a lot of police officers. And then I was doing a lot of city council type stuff. So got to sit up there in the chamber and, you know, listen to all that was going on. So I was very much a beat reporter in terms of just, like, consistently doing the stuff that needed to be done. You know, when you sit and you ask me about specific stories, getting mm-hmm. them together for me now, I'd have to really go back because I had, like, archives at home. And really think about some of the cases and things that were going on. I know that, there was some big court cases that were happening. But when you mix it up with my time at WMBD, WCIA, and then that Fox time frame, it all kind of like starts to melt together for me. So,
well, that was at
I can't remember specifically.
That's all right. That was at a time though when I think the police chiefs in Bloomington and Normal finally admitted that there was a gang problem in Bloomington Normal, which for many years they denied. But when it started coming out in court case after court case that the people who were being prosecuted had gang ties, you know, I remember finally presenting them with the evidence, and they had to admit we had a gang problem. And I think that was the beginning of a real full-scale assault on gangs, because they learned from going to conferences and so forth that the way you combat gangs is to first acknowledge that you have a problem. And I remember that was kind of a big ongoing issue back during that time frame. That's when you had Operation Gangbusters and things like that going on.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is because that was the very first professional journalism career job that I had, I was really focused on honing my skills and figuring out how it was all done. And what's interesting to me is really a funny thing that you said to me once, Colleen. You said to me way back in that time frame, it's something I still laugh about, obviously. And it's the fact that, you know, you said, Maria, what you say doesn't always make sense when you read the news, but you always say it like it does. And the way you said it to me was, you sound like, you know, you're so authoritative and you have so much credibility, but, you know, sometimes our copy wasn't always correct, didn't always make sense. And all of us were reporters doing stuff on the fly. So I would sit there and you get to the point sometimes where you're not interpreting, you're just reading. And I remember Colleen saying, you know, it doesn't always make sense, but it really sounds like it does when you read it. Well, I think there's a compliment in there somewhere.
Yeah, of course. You also did some time on our FM station as a morning news person over there with Scott Lachlan and at the time Scott Robbins, and that was interesting for you, wasn't it?
I did have a great time there, and that was a lot of fun in the morning. And that was a little different experience because it's laid back. So you can joke around, you can mess around with topics, and you can kind of be playful. And I always work to writing that line when you're in news was always kind of touchy. It is not the same now. It is not the same. You know, I would, so over the years I've done adjunct work at ISU in journalism, and I at one point was teaching German exchange students who come over, and I would do like workshop here and there where I was talking to them about, you know, American journalism. And I remember students in class asking me very confused, how do you know about American humor? they couldn't tell the difference between the Daily Show and like our regular nightly news, and they were having difficult time making the distinctions. And so, you know, we as journalists would always have a hard time trying to write those lines. But over the years, I got really good at that. And to be honest, and I'm sure you guys understand this too, when social media kind of picked up and started to just become this pervasive part of all of our lives, we actually had good boundaries that we were taught over the years as to what you do and don't share and how you do some of that. I know that there's a lot of people who have different philosophies on the record, off the record, but I always kind of felt like I had a good training ground in media on how to basically cope with social media when it came around so that it wasn't as, you know, hard to just basically draw lines.
That was our Throwback Thursday interview with Maria Henneberry with Dan and Colleen. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Local officials in Bloomington Normal are going to try to save the Mitsubishi plant as the company announced it plans to halt production in Normal in November. Normal Mayor Chris Koo says work is underway to find a new use for the plant.
We need to embrace this decision by Mitsubishi as a new opportunity for our community and to aggressively engage key local, state, and federal leaders to help us develop an aggressive strategy to find a new owner for the local Mitsubishi facility.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner says the community has to come together.
I know that our state officials and our other local officials, we're all committed to making sure that we make progress in our community. So we've gotten through tough times in the past. We'll get through this as well.
Congressman Rodney Davis told our Joe Ragusa he's going to work on keeping those jobs in Normal. He's just not sure how yet.
Well, I wish I could give you a succinct answer on this, Joe, but this is the first time a large facility like this that has, you know, so many good paying jobs that are, you know, that people go to and families go to every day. That's the first time it's ever happened to me in my district.
Multiple employees have told WJBC they'll be let go starting in May of next year if a buyer for the plant isn't found. Authorities believe the man accused of murdering Pamela Zimmerman of Bloomington did it because he was frustrated with the way their relationship ended. Kirk Zimmerman is charged with the first-degree murder. His bond this week was set at $5 million. The two divorced in 2012 after 20 years of marriage. And the probable cause statement read in court said Kirk Zimmerman was frustrated with how much money he was paying in child support. State's Attorney Jason Chambers says gunshot residue found inside Kirk Zimmerman's car helped connect him to the murder.
The way that I've described it is if I put a handful of BBs on top of my car and drove around for 5 miles, those BBs aren't going to be on my car anymore. The BBs still exist. So they're very durable, but they can disperse very easily.
Pamela Zimmerman was shot to death November 3rd, a day after she returned from a trip with her boyfriend where she got engaged. Rod Blagojevich's wife says the family is disappointed in a court ruling this week that dismissed only some of the ex-governor's corruption convictions. But Patty Blagojevich says her husband is still hopeful that justice will prevail eventually.
My husband's a patriotic person. He believes in the promise of our country and a promise of our legal system and our justice system. And he believes that at some point it's got to be made right. And at some point the promise of fairness and truth prevailing, it's got to come true.
The court dismissed 5 of 18 counts against Blagojevich and sent the case back for resentencing, though U.S. District Judge James Zagel could reimpose the original 14-year sentence. The Bloomington Public Library Board still trying to figure out what to do with the lack of bookmobile stops on the city's west side. WJBC's Joe Ragusa says discussion on the issue was contentious this week.
Board member Susan O'Rourke had an issue with Board President Carol Koos trying to end discussion after about 40 minutes.
As I recall, we elected you president. Mm-hmm. We did not make you a demigod.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And shutting down conversation by the entire board is not productive.
You have not been shut down. We've had a 2-hour board meeting already, and I think that we need to move on to the next topic.
No action was taken regarding the bookmobile Tuesday by the board. Many of the trustees agreed that more research into the topic needs to be done, and some are worried the real issue is a lack of registered library members. Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
And Central Illinois Arena Management answered questions from the Bloomington City Council about another bad year financially for U.S. Cellular Coliseum. The Coliseum operated at a near $500,000 loss in the last fiscal year, a figure that doesn't account for debt service payments on the facility. CIAM President John Butler is also the owner of BMI Concessions, which runs the concession stands for events at the Coliseum.
My obligation in order to get the food and beverage rights was to pay up to $1 million, spend $1 million of my own money for the equipment in the building. So I have skin in the game.
And a developer estimates he could save the city of Bloomington up to $35 million over the next decade if he could take over its three golf courses. Jim Pearson has proposed privatizing Highland Park, the Den, and Prairie Vista. He tells WJBC's Scott Laughlin he's concerned the city's financial constraints could cause those courses to suffer.
What I don't want to see is that the quality of play at the Den and Prairie Vista go steadily downhill. And if the city has a budget crunch, then I would like to try to keep those courses really well-maintained and viable.
City officials have expressed concerns that Highland Park is losing money at a time when the city faces a deficit. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now to take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, a group from Illinois People's Action in Bloomington will travel to Springfield to lobby against Governor Rauner's proposed budget cuts. Republican Scott Walker brings his presidential campaign to Bloomington on Monday as he campaigns with congressional candidate Darren LaHood. Bloomington's city council will also meet on Monday night. On Tuesday, state tourism officials will be in Bloomington to release Illinois tourism's economic impact numbers. And on Saturday, St. Jude runners will travel on foot from Bloomington to Peoria to present a check at the annual St. Jude Telethon on TV 25. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.